Good evening, everybody. We ready for a meeting? My name is Jeff, and I am an alcoholic. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speaker Meeting at the NAVA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with one or more years of sobriety tells his or her story. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe that is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. And it's an honor to always introduce speakers on Monday nights. Gentleman speaking tonight, I met him at a Sunday night 8 o'clock meeting, which I believe he is, that's one of his home groups, and he is there every Sunday night sharing and talking to people and doing the deal. And with that, I give you Owen Jones.
My name is Owen Jones. I'm very grateful to be an alcoholic and see some familiar faces here tonight. It's a really great feeling for me. It's a relatively new feeling to be close to people who care about me, other than obviously my wife and my kids who actually speak to me. That's if you're an alcoholic like me and your grown children still speak to you, that's quite a thing, and I owe that all to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and the fellowship is all about people that we open our hearts to each other and something very powerful happens. If there's one of the themes tonight, maybe that I'm a slow learner. the lady who was instrumental in getting me sober and into AA, her name was Geraldine Owen Delaney. She had, at the time, 37 years of sobriety and had gotten sober in Bill W.'s group in Manhattan back in the 1940s. And she was kind of my AA mentor for a while. I had a sponsor, but she was still kind of my AA mentor for quite a while. What?
Any water?
No, I have one right here. Thanks. But she told me one time, she says, you need to learn how to develop a good sense of humor. And I had no idea what she was talking about. But I went out and bought a joke book. Because I thought she meant, you need to learn how to be funny. She meant dawned on me about 18 years later sitting in an AA meeting. I went like, oh! And I realized that she saw something in me right from the very beginning that it took me 18 years to discover, and that was that I took myself too damn seriously. And that caused me all kinds of problems in sobriety as well. So that I was about 12 years sober and suicidal because I had made a lot of very bad, impulsive decisions and didn't have a very good perspective on myself. But with that said, I should mention that my wife and I went out to one of these kind of natural foods restaurants, and they advertised free-range chicken on the menu. So the waitress came by and gave us the menus, and we were looking at the menus for a while, and she came back over to take our order, and I said, well, how do you prepare the chickens? And she says, well, we feel like it's important to just be upfront and honest with them, and we tell them, you're not going to make it. So, how'd I do? Not too good, huh? Actually, that could also be kind of a theme of my story, that I really wasn't prepared for this world, you know? I mean, I got no preparation for life. I used to blame, you know, the world for it. I used to blame my family for it, my parents. Because they weren't very good parents. My dad was an alcoholic. My mother was a pill addict. There was a lot of anger in the house. My dad was a very angry alcoholic. A lot of yelling. And I was the youngest of three children, and so all that anger would just kind of, you know, float down to me, and I was the brunt of, you know, the anger, a lot of anger from three people. My mother being on Valium, she didn't seem very angry. I thought she was like a saint until I realized that she was on Valium, Librium, Xanax, Elavil, Melaril, Haldol, and every time the doctors gave her a new prescription, he would never get rid of any of the previous prescriptions. And after my dad died, I put her into treatment, which she didn't appreciate because they took all her drugs away. She got home from treatment and started calling me in the middle of the night, saying, you. That's how she said it, really. Isn't it? Five foot two, 74 years old, 70 years, you know, something like that. 67, I think, at that time. You, I'm going to come over there and chop your head off with an axe. And I would call my brother and I would say, you know, have you heard from Mom recently? No. And would you call her and see if she's okay? And so he called me back and I said, well, did you call her? And he said, well, yeah. And how did she seem? Well, fine. So I think she was really upset with me for taking her drugs away. And that's the last time I had anything to do with her. She died 7 years later in the fetal position with a feeding tube in her stomach as the result of all of the brain atrophy from the pills and the alcohol, and then towards the end she couldn't buy booze, she couldn't leave the house, she couldn't get anybody to buy her booze, but she could get the maid to buy mouthwash. So she would drink about, I don't know, a gallon of mouthwash every day. And that's an example of this disease, which is a family disease quite often. Let's see how I want to segue into what I want to talk about here, because I don't want to spend too much time on the family or I'll never get sober. I did that once. I talked for 55 minutes and I wasn't even sober yet. My dad looked a lot like John Wayne. I mean, a lot like John Wayne. He was about 6'1 or 2 and looked a lot like him, sounded like him, had his deep baritone voice. And my mom looked like Granny on the Beverly Hillbillies on a bad day. So it was an interesting couple. And my mother came from a wealthy, educated family, and my dad grew up in an orphanage. Out of respect for my father-in-law, or my grandfather, rather, my mother's father, who had set my dad up in business, he was raised a Baptist, But he would take the kids to church every Sunday morning because the church had been founded by my grandfather. Which was interesting because my mother was a devout atheist. She would never darken the door of a church. But every Sunday morning, I was in church growing up. And I remember as a child praying fervently and sincerely to God to help my father. And my church experience was okay. It was pretty good. Nothing, no bad experiences. A lot of people in AA, I know, talk about like they were tortured in church or something. And that was not my experience. It was a Congregationalist type church, you know. If you were like a Christian kind of liberal progressive person in my small southern Florida town, and you wanted to go to church, this was the church that you went to, and it was very kind of rationalistic and so on. There was certainly no fire and brimstone preaching there. As time went on, I was desperate for somebody to save me from my home situation, and I used to fantasize that the minister was going to knock on the door one day and said, "I'm here for Owen. I'm going to take him with me." I knew that had to happen. And why wasn't it happening? Don't they know? Don't they know? Then I remember one day, and I'm going to talk about this throughout my life a little bit more than maybe you're used to hearing in AA meetings, but because my religious experience is very closely tied to my drinking, my alcoholism, and my sobriety, my religious history. And it does say in the book, and it does encourage us to, you know, to get involved in a religion, to seek out spiritual guidance from ministers or rabbis or priests. And, you know, the stuff behind me there on the wall didn't just drop out of the sky. It was derived from mostly from my religious tradition and has been adapted, thank God, for alcoholics. But anyway, I remember I had this kind of vision in church one day. I was looking at everybody, looking up towards the altar, and I said, "Don't they realize that there's nothing up there? It's a blank wall. There's nothing there. I mean, that's really stupid. They're just looking at a blank wall. Don't they realize there's nothing there?" And that was kind of the beginning, I think, of my adolescent atheism. And it was combined with just the kind of pain of my alcoholic family experience. It was not unexpected, I suppose, that I would like reject God at that point. Although there was one other experience I remember very clearly. I was coming home. I came home from camp after the sixth grade, and every day, every weekday anyway, of my life up to that point, there was a woman in my life who was very significant. Her name was Luella. And my parents had hired her the day I was born to take me home and take care of me, kind of. But to call her a nanny was a little, you know, bit of a stretch. She was a very poor, semi-educated black lady who they had hired, which was typical of many, you know, middle-class white families in the Deep South. And the children would become closer to their nanny, or whatever you want to call her, than to their own parents. And I loved her. I loved her in a way that I didn't realize. I just had this natural relationship with her. A wonderful person, at least to me. And I came home after camp, after my sixth grade, and my parents informed me that Luella was not going to be around anymore. And it never occurred to me, that that might happen. This came as like a huge blow. And I remember at that moment, I turned against my parents. And the thought occurred to me, you're the enemy. You have taken from me the one person that I love, that I rely on, the one rock of stability in my life. I hate you. And then that carried over into God, you know, like, you haven't done a whole lot for me either. And by the time I was in high school, I thought of myself as an atheist, and like my mother, thought that anybody who believed in God was just stupid, you know, ignorant, superstitious, and just stupid, you know. And then I had my first drinking experience. My parents were invited out for the evening to some social event, which was unique because my dad was a very angry, very sloppy, very loud drunk who sometimes ended up falling down in public. And everybody, he was a very prominent businessman in town. He was a very, very prominent politically in town, and everybody knew he couldn't handle his booze, so they never got invited out. But they did get invited out this time. It was the first time in my life I had been home at night by myself, like age 14. And the thought occurred to me, I need a drink. Now, I hated my dad. I hated his drinking. So why in the world would that be the only thought that would enter my mind? And, of course, what we know about alcoholism now, what I know about it, is that alcoholism centers in the mind. So I was an alcoholic before my first drink. And I found some booze, I found some of my mother's pills, I popped a couple of Valium and chug-a-lugged a pint, and had I been observed or caught in my behavior subsequent to that, I probably would have been shipped off to an adolescent psychiatric hospital. Thank God nobody observed my behavior. My conclusion was, okay, I can drink, but I better not combine it with those pills. So I never took any more pills. I just drank. By the way, I apologize. I know this is an AA meeting, but my story does not include drugs, other than a couple of Valium. That was funny, wasn't it? Good sense of humor. There's a little sense of humor there. I never got arrested for DUI, although I could have many times. I tried to kill two people with my bare hands while in an anger blackout, not an alcoholic blackout, but an anger blackout. One of whom was a business partner and one of whom was my dad. I would have gone to jail for trying to kill my business partner had I not gotten a very good attorney who got me off on a technicality, the speedy trial law. So if you're ever in Florida and you're charged with a crime, what you need to do is get a good attorney to delay, and then go into the judge and say, but Your Honor, the speedy trial law has, you know, the period under the speedy trial law has expired. You can't try my client. And that's, he came out of the courtroom and he says, "Let's get the hell out of here." And we ran to the exit. He says, "I've seen judges call the bailiff, change their minds, call the bailiff, and come get you and drag you back in." Had no idea the seriousness of, you know, my problem. My last drink about 18 years later was one beer. Just one beer. And the reason why it was one beer was I was trying to prove to myself that I did not have a problem by drinking one beer. I figured if I could just drink one beer that night, I was okay. I didn't have a problem. I got in here because I was sitting across the desk from Mrs. Delaney, and she looked me in the eye and she said, "You've got a problem." She said, "And your problem is you don't know who you are. And you need to do something about that. And you need to begin by admitting that you're an alcoholic and joining AA." And I remember that moment like it was yesterday, and it's coming up on 30 years. Something happened at that point. Now, the old me would have thought this. Might not have said it, but this is what I would have thought. "Who the hell are you to talk to me that way? You don't know anything about me. We haven't even discussed my drinking. You don't know what I've been through. You don't know what I've experienced. How dare you?" And I would be plotting my escape. I would be planning on, you know, politely listening to her and hearing her out. And then as soon as I was through the door, I was going to be gone. Well, that's not what happened. Something else happened. I felt a change coming over me. I felt lighter than air. I felt like I had been carrying around up to that point in my life a 100-pound sack of fertilizer on each shoulder that had just been lifted off my shoulders. Now, I know what a 100-pound sack of fertilizer feels like on the shoulder because I used to work in my dad's citrus business, and I used to toss a lot of 100-pound bags of fertilizer, so I know what they feel like, and that's the best description I can give you of that feeling at that moment. And it's as if God had put his hand over my mouth and whispered in my ear and said, "You better not say anything. You better just listen to what this person is telling you, because this is the most important thing you'll ever hear in your life." And, you know, religious language, you know, we have a lot of people, understandably, in AA who talk about spirituality versus religion, which is fine as long as we're not saying that we're spiritual and religious people aren't. But I had, I think there's, and a lot of people have had a lot of difficult experiences in church, but a lot of it is just a misunderstanding, I think, about religious language. And so, for example, obviously it didn't happen literally that way. God did not enter the room and slap a hand over my mouth and start speaking in my ear. But that's the only way I have to describe it to give you an idea of what it felt like and what happened. So that's a kind of example of using religious language in a way that there's really no other way to describe. But the point is, I had a spiritual experience, which I attribute to God. And people right afterwards, we were in this group, and they said I looked different. I certainly felt different. And I got home a few days later and went to my first AA meeting. It was all motorcycle gang members and me. And when I introduced myself as a newcomer, they held a first step meeting for me in the side room. And they went around talking about not so much what they drank or how much they drank, but what it felt like inside and what changes they were going through and what they felt like now. And for the first time in my life, I started to make connections with other people, certainly for the first time since I started drinking. So I was not a social drinker. I was a lonely, lonesome, private drinker. Okay? One of the reasons why I didn't get any DUIs. I remember thinking, oh, I'll give this 2 weeks. You know, because I figured that was... Even 2 weeks was beyond imagination for not being able to drink. But I figured, you know, to give it a shot, I figured, you know, I could probably not drink for 2 weeks. Maybe. And within 2 weeks, I was sold. I was sold on AA. Part of the thing that helped me was that I was no longer an atheist at that point. I had read some things that helped me arrive at the conclusion that atheism was not intellectually credible for me anymore. Now, I realize there are atheists and agnostics in AA. You know, and that's okay. And some of them stay sober a long time. But at that point, I was really involved in my church. And I could recognize I was getting a religious education or theological education somewhat. And I could recognize as soon as I saw the steps, you know, I get this. You know, so my religious training, such as it was coming before AA, was a huge help. A huge help. I didn't come in here with no reference point to be able to look at the steps and at least appreciate and understand that this was something familiar to me. And for a lot of people who come in, it isn't. It's like a totally foreign, alien language, and a lot of struggle is involved to begin accepting, you know, what the steps have to offer to us, just because, you know, we don't even understand what some of the words mean. But that wasn't my case, so that was a huge help. Since then, I have found a lot of help, outside help, we call it. You know, sometimes some of us need a shrink. Well, I needed a religious tradition, call it, that would fill in some of the blanks that AA leaves blank, and for good reason, because we don't want to get involved in religious debates in AA. There was an organization called the Washingtonians. If you read some of the AA history books, like AA Comes of Age, this is talked about. There was a very successful group in the 19th century. doing a great job with alcoholics, but they got involved in theological disputes and it just imploded. We also don't get involved in political debates, thank God, in AA meetings. I've gotten in a few after the meeting, and that's, I'm trying to avoid that now. And there was the example of the Oxford groups, which was kind of what got the original AA people sober. And what happened there was the founder, who was a Lutheran minister, decided that if he could communicate the principles of the Oxford group to Hitler, then he could persuade Hitler to avoid going to war. So he traveled to Nazi Germany, and Hitler saw Patsy coming, you know, a mile off. And he schmoozed the guy and said, yes, yes, oh yes, this is wonderful, and absolutely, and you know, we're not gonna go to war, blah, blah, blah. And so, you know, he leaves and he's ecstatic, the minister, and you know, I've had this wonderful meeting with Hitler, you know, and he understands. And immediately upon Hitler invading Poland, the Oxford group ceased to exist virtually overnight, because they had lost all credibility. And so, you know, for us to maintain our integrity, you know, we have to, in my opinion, we have to really follow those traditions and not get involved in outside controversies and so on. It's vital, absolutely vital. So what's happened since? I talked about being a slow learner. I love AA, and I feel like I've only scratched the surface of what AA has to offer to me. More importantly, and this is a kind of a frustration of mine, I feel like I've only scratched the surface of what I have to offer back to AA. I very much like what Dr. Bob has to say. He talks about the reasons why he keeps coming back, and one of them is that he owes a debt to AA that he'll never be able to repay. And that's my feeling. I'm sure it saved my life. I'm sure it saved my marriage. And as I mentioned, I have three grown children who still speak to me. I mean, that's a miracle right there. And at 63 years old, I'm really looking forward to learning in AA about how to apply these spiritual principles in my life, not only that I might be at peace, but that I might have something to share with the newcomer that will be helpful to him. But it's not just the peace we share, it's also our suffering that we have to share. In fact, according to this book, that's our biggest asset. So I'm going to read my favorite line from the book, a couple lines. It's in the family afterword on page 124. Showing others who suffer how we were given help is the very thing which makes life seem so worthwhile to us now. So frequently I feel I have feelings of uselessness and self-pity. I know no one in here has ever had those feelings, right? But I have those. And so this is for me. This is written for me. Because AA gives me a purpose, the ability to share something with the newcomer that you don't have to drink anymore. You don't have to die. You don't have to suffer anymore. And the reason I know is I've suffered. I've been through what you've been through. Here's my story. And that gives me a powerful sense of meaning and purpose to have that to share with others. And then it goes on to say, cling to the thought that in God's hands, the dark past is the greatest possession you have, the key to life and happiness for others. With it, you can avert death and misery for them.
Wow.
Right. Now, there are a lot of people in a life-saving business, okay? There are EMTs, there are doctors and nurses, and so on and so forth. And I don't regret for 1 minute that they get paid. The more they get paid, the better, in my opinion. If I have brain surgery, I want some guys making $5 million a year, not some guy that's making $50,000 a year, okay? But it's a great privilege as an AA member to think maybe, just maybe, I might have something to share from my dark past that could potentially save another person's life. Wow. That is really powerful stuff. And, you know, when you get past, I had to find something in AA that I loved more than the alcohol to keep me coming back. Okay? And that's it. That's AA is not just keeping me sober in the sense of absence from alcohol, but it's giving my life meaning and purpose, which I wouldn't have an opportunity to find otherwise. You know, I'm trying to make a ton of money from a business, but that's more for practical reasons. It doesn't really give my life meaning and purpose. This does, believe me. And then I just want to say, and I'm not proselytizing for my religion, I'm just saying it's an important part of my story. I did find a religious home which doesn't contradict anything in here and vice versa, and complements, and rather complements. And then I have questions that AA is not supposed to address. Like, what happens when I die? I'm 63 years old. That's my imitation of Donald Trump, by the way. What happens when you die? I want to know what people have to say about that. I'm 63 years old. I'm thinking about that. You know, we don't get in that kind of discussion in here, and probably for good reason. So I need to go to a place where they address stuff like that. But I will say this, as a slow learner, I was, and I'm a high bottom drunk, okay? By most common definitions in AA. So I did not come in here physically on death's door. And it took me a long time to really understand and really appreciate and really accept that AA is about life and death. It really, truly is about life and death. It offers me a daily choice of life or death. First of all, it's given me a choice. I never had choices before. I just did whatever I was driven to do. Didn't know there was such a thing as choices. I was completely a slave to alcohol and all of the sick range of emotions, fear, rage, you know, all of those things associated with it, giving me choices. Beautiful thing. And AA reminds me on a daily basis that every day I'm making a choice between life and death as an AA member. And I didn't discover that in here so much as a passage I ran across in here. Now, this book was written in 1939. Before that, this is called the Big Book. Some people call this the Big, Big Book, which was used by a lot of early AAs, Holy Bible. which was used by many early AAs. In meetings, they would read, they would have a reading from the book, particularly from the Book of James, which is a more practically oriented a book of how to apply spiritual principles to your life. So I read this, and a light bulb came on. You know, I was probably sober 18 years at this point. And this light bulb, I was like, oh, wow, okay. So I'm going to close with this. First of all, I just want to read a short passage that, you know, people say, well, the Old Testament is about this angry, punishing God, you know. Well, this is Moses saying goodbye to everybody. Now it shall be when all these things come upon you, the blessing and the curse which I have set before you, and you will reflect in your heart among all the nations where the Lord your God scatters you, and you return to the Lord your God and obey his voice, from your whole heart and from your whole soul, according to all I command you today, that the Lord will heal your sins, have mercy on you. So heal your sins. Wow. You know, that's what we're doing here. If you properly understand what a sin is, it's kind of a malady. It's not necessarily breaking a moral law. It's more like a sickness. Otherwise, why would they say, heal your sins? Have mercy on you and gather you again from all the nations where the Lord your God scattered you. And boy, was I scattered. You know, I was really scattered. And then there's this passage. For this commandment I command you today, it's not too burdensome for you. You know, we don't ask anybody in here, we say, well, it's hard doing this stuff, it's hard getting sober, but it's not too hard that anybody can do it. Okay, anybody who comes in here can be a success. It's not too burdensome for you, nor is it far off. It is not in heaven above that you should say, who will ascend into heaven for us and bring it to us that we may hear and do it, nor is it beyond the sea, blah blah blah. So, you know, in AA, I found the presence of God very nearby. Before, it was always very far off. And then finally, there's this. If your heart turns away and you do not hear but go astray and worship different gods and serve them, I announce to you today you shall surely perish. Well, I worshipped alcohol, and if I go back to that God, I'm going to die. It's just simple. You tell me that every meeting. You remind me of that every meeting. I call heaven and earth as witnesses today against you. I set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore, choose life. And it dawned on me, you know, that what AA is all about. At that point, I was probably 18 years sober. Wow. You know, that's what it's really all about. If I, you know, AA is asking me to choose life and not die. God does not want me to die. He doesn't want me to choose the things that will lead to death. First, a spiritual death that will then lead to usually a pretty miserable physical death from alcoholism. So I try to combine the two, but I would never substitute one for the other. I certainly wouldn't recommend anybody, you know, substituting their church or religious life for what AA has to offer, or necessarily vice versa. But I found combining the two, at least for me, works. And the literature encourages us to at least take a look, examine, see what's out there, you know, and give it a try. I've never had anybody in church or in here put a gun to my head and say, if you don't do it this way, I'm going to pull the trigger. You know, I'm just so grateful that these timeless spiritual principles are there for me and all of us, and the fact that, you know, whatever it took to get me here to find them was all worth it. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Owen. I believe Chris is going to be doing the chips for
us. Hi, it's Chris Burns, Great Bowl Common Alcoholic.
Hey, Chris.
Here at Navigate the Chip System, if you mark your time away from your last drink, that's a good place. So we'll start with the white chip. It's the International Sign of Surrender. If you'd like to try a new way of life one day at a time, come on up and get one.
My sleep.